Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the differing reactions to the Nunes memo, which has underwhelmed many while confirming the darkest conspiracy theories of those already riled up by Fox News and right-wing media. David Schultz, a professor of political science at the University of Minnesota School of Law and author of American Politics in the Age of Ignorance, Why Lawmakers Choose Belief Over Research, joins us to discuss the weaponization of conspiracy theories by Donald Trump, who has moved on from his inauguration message of American carnage to his current invention of American disgrace. With Trump seizing on the Nunes memo, which he helped orchestrate as the Fox News echo chamber pumps out pro-Trump propaganda, the president appears to be doubling down on his attacks on the FBI and DOJ, with Rod Rosenstein in the crosshairs as a next target to be forced out by a president who, at the very least, if he does not succeed in shutting down or neutering the special counsel's inquiry, will now be able to avoid testifying to Mueller on the grounds which the bogus Nunes memo has provided. Then we will speak with an award-winning journalist, Walter Shapiro, who has covered the last 10 presidential campaigns and is a columnist for Roll Call, a fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University, and teaches political science at Yale. He joins us to discuss his article at The Guardian, "The Nunes Memo Shows Republicans Buy Their Own Conspiracy Theories," and whether Trump has succeeded in not just getting away with not releasing his tax returns and making a mockery of the Emoluments Clause, but creating the pretext for either ending, delaying, or neutering the Mueller investigation. Then finally, we'll assess the aspects of today's Super Bowl that the NFL is not emphasizing, and that includes declining attendance, the corporatization of football, what a career playing pro football does to the human brain, and what happened to the Take a Knee protest movement started by the 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick. Ben Carrington, a professor at the Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism at USC and author of Race, Sport, and Politics, joins us to look into why Trump's swipe at NFL protesters got the most applause at his recent State of the Union address. Joining us now, David Schultz, a professor of political science at Hamline University and the University of Minnesota School of Law. He's the author of 30 books and various articles on American politics, ethics, election law, and the media. Has written most recently Presidential Swing States, Why Only 10 Matter, Election Law and Democratic Theory, and American Politics in the Age of Ignorance, Why Lawmakers Choose Belief Over Research. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Schultz.
Thank you very much.
And talk about your last book, Why Lawmakers Choose Belief Over Research. Some of the stuff that's being said by some of these Tea Party Republicans, congresspeople, is just mind-boggling. How not only preceding the release of this Nunes memo, but since its release, when it's clearly a dud, but you wouldn't know that from Fox News World, where they're just in such a lather over it. But Mark Meadows and these Tea Party guys, and there's a dentist in Arizona who's calling the FBI and DOJ people named in the memo traitors. Talk about hyperbole here. And in general, this is a case of a weaponized conspiracy theory. That's the way I would describe the so-called Nunes memo.
It is exactly that. There's sort of two points that you're making here. You know, one of them, even before this memo, we have to think in terms of both the partisan and economic interests which are driving why we have this sort of rise of alternative facts and contested of basic propositions, you know, that many of us accept to be true. And I think that's clearly the case. Again, economic interests having reasons for wanting to contest or challenge basic propositions, that, again, in terms of science, in terms of global warming, in terms of climate science, and just in terms of basic everyday facts that we might accept. And then also there are powerful partisan political interests reinforced by, let us say, some forms of the media that are also an effort to do what? To cast doubt and to offer an alternative perspective in terms of how to think about the world. And we put those two together and we have some of the rise that we're seeing here now in terms of alternative facts. And now it also generates this doubt among many, many people in terms of what is actually true and what is false.
Well, but to my mind, this wouldn't be happening. And somebody, I think it was Geraldo Rivera, in conversation with Sean Hannity, made the point that had Fox News been around when Nixon was about to be impeached, Nixon probably would have stayed in the Oval Office. The role of Fox is so central to all of this. I get enormous amounts of solicitations from these right-wing, you know, Koch brothers type think tanks and propaganda mills. So I've been watching the build-up weeks now for this memo. And interestingly, in the first Letterman show, that the guest was former President Obama, Obama was asked, what's the greatest challenge for America going forward? And he said, well, he quoted Senator Moynihan saying, you know, Moynihan once said that everybody's entitled to their own opinions, but not their own facts. But nowadays, there is no consensus on what is a fact. If you watch Fox News, you'd be on another planet than if you listen to NPR. Well, Fox played that clip, but they cut off the last part about if you listen to NPR. So they deliberately riled up their people with a completely manipulated statement by President Obama insulting Fox viewers. That's the kind of tactics that we're dealing with here. So is there any way for us to get out of this kind of Goebbels-like mediascape and somehow stop this poisoning of the discourse, which has clearly in this country been tribalized basically since the introduction of Fox News? And that's not to mention that MSNBC on the other side, they don't tribalize their discourse as well.
I think this is the challenge of our lifetime right now. And I would also throw into it, it's not just Fox and MSNBC. It's now how a lot of this misinformation is now circulated on the social media through Facebook, Twitter, and so forth. And it just perpetuates and exacerbates some of this partisan divide and this misinformation. But no, you're raising the challenge that I see as an educator also. That with my students, I find that, for example, all my students will know that at some point some study concluded that vaccinations cause autism, but almost none of them know the fact that that story, that scientific report, was roundly refuted and discredited. And there seems to be something out there, and this is hard to figure out why bad information, misinformation, seems to have greater staying power than truth and accuracy. And perhaps maybe it speaks to something that the American historian Richard Hofstadter talked about, which is that within American politics, there is this tradition of both a paranoid style and both an anti-intellectual style in American politics, that there's this, again, fear oftentimes and distrust of intellectuals. There is this sense in which oftentimes that in a society that is really kind of a mass society where we seem to defer to the majority, a distrust of experts. And we see that distrust, whether it is in terms of the media, whether it's in terms of the FBI, whether it's the CIA. It's not to say that those institutions are flawless, but at the end of the day, we may be fighting a deeper cultural battle in the United States that now is only exacerbated by the social media and a return to the partisan media. I'd like to point out, when I teach some of my classes back at Hamline University, that take us back to the early 19th century, no one ever expected the news to be fair and impartial. No one expected Thomas Paine or Benjamin Franklin to say, let's give equal and opposing time to the British. It's that it was highly partisan, but we've created a nonpartisan, what I call Walter Cronkite era of the media after World War II, that served us well through Watergate. But it collapsed in the 80s, and it's really degenerated now to the point where this does become a difficulty. I mean, how do we find places where we can trust, sources that we can trust, where we can have conversations where people agree upon some of the most basic propositions that I think are important for our society? This is really, I think, where we are, not just divided on facts, but powerfully divided on culture, divided in such a world that, you know, we eat at different restaurants, shop at different stores. We, as Daniel Patrick Moynihan said, we hold different facts to be true.
And again, I'm speaking with David Schultz, who's a professor of political science at Hamline University and the University of Minnesota School of Law. He's the author of 30 books and various articles on American politics, ethics, election law, and the media, and most recently wrote Presidential Swing States, Why Only 10 Matter, Election Law and Democratic Theory, and American Politics in the Age of Ignorance, Why Lawmakers Choose Belief Over Research. Well, my sense, though, is that, and by the way, I think that, you know, it's not out of the question that Trump is planning on firing Rod Rosenstein, and he could well neuter this investigation. And I think that to some extent, Paul Ryan and others are going along with that because perhaps their strategy is to make sure that this report doesn't come out before the elections. And that seems to be the way it's heading. But if the reverse happens, if somehow or other Mueller is able to finish his inquiry and it is released to the public, it would have to be incredibly convincing and pretty bulletproof. Otherwise, you're never going to convince the people in the Fox bubble, many of whom have assault rifles and lots of weaponry, that their hero has not been a victim of a hoax, as he keeps saying, but actually should be impeached. So they're going to have to make a bulletproof case. But that leads to the observation that's unassailable, that who has created this mindset amongst these people? And there, again, I go back to Fox News and Rupert Murdoch. And I think this country could be in for, I mean, if, for example, because of what Trump has just said about the FBI, there's another Waco or Ruby Ridge and a bunch of FBI people are shot, I would say that the blood is on Trump's hands. And if there is social unrest and an upheaval as a result of the Mueller report, then the blood would be on Rupert Murdoch's hands.
I think you're right. I mean, I'm going to call it the cosmic pizza example. Remember the story from during the election cycle where there was this rumor perpetuated that there was a pizza place that was harboring, what is it, I believe, what, you know, children, you know, who were being sexually molested and so forth.
By Hillary Clinton.
By Hillary Clinton, that's right. And some guy goes there with a gun storming it, thinking he's going to liberate, you know, these people, and eventually realizes, I think what his quote was, well, I was misinformed. Well, yes, words matter. Words do matter. And when you constantly feed people the notion of that in fact, let's say the FBI is equal, that the government is bad, that you can't trust certain types of people, you foment hate. Eventually, at some point, you create the ideology and the climate to do really nasty things. And I think that's what Trump has done. I think the most dangerous thing that Trump is doing right now with the Nunes memo is about, is at the end of the day, it's a hack memo. I mean, there's all kinds of reasons why we can point to how it's factually inaccurate, why it's legally inaccurate, but really what it is, it's the lattice work. It is the, I don't know, what the shield or sword, I'm not sure what the metaphor I'm looking for here, to basically discredit the Mueller investigation, but more importantly, to discredit the independence of the Justice Department and the FBI to seek truth. And I think that is one of the fundamental differences between now and Watergate. At the end of the day with Watergate, there were many books that concluded, said the irony was that the system worked, that the Justice Department still worked, the courts did their job, the special prosecutors did their job, the Justice Department, after some purges, for people who refused to go along with Nixon and the backlash, did its job too. And this is the real danger here, the danger that Trump and the Republicans are conspiring together to undermine, I would call it, basic respect for rule of law. And if you don't have that basic respect for rule of law and integrity, that's one of the fine lines that separates autocratic societies from democracies.
Well, it is an extraordinary situation that Trump, to my mind, appears to be winning. And I'm astounded that this sort of orange blowhard, this pathetic narcissist, is able to do what he does and get away with what he gets away with. He's never released his tax returns. And now, even if he doesn't fire Rosenstein and, by extension, Mueller, he might well be able to neuter this investigation. But what he's already achieved is that he's not going to testify to Mueller, which is something that his lawyers were terrified about. I can guarantee you now he's going to say, well, why should I testify before a kangaroo court? So he's already won that round, hasn't he?
Yeah, he has won that round, and he's, I think, going to win a couple of more rounds, and that's why I think it is that race to the clock. The other thing I want to describe here is that what's also dangerous is that you kind of hope that the basic principles of our constitutional system, separation of powers and checks and balances, would kick in, that at some point that would also be able to establish the lines that prevents Trump from doing what he's doing. And one of the things that is, again, distinguishing us from Watergate is the powerful strength of partisanship today. I remember recently going back and watching an old clip with an interview from Senator Howard Baker back during the Watergate era, a Republican. He was the one who had coined the phrase during the Watergate era, what did the president know and what did he know it? And there was an interview I saw with him where a reporter expressed concern about whether Nixon was going to get away with what he was doing. And Howard Baker kind of looks to the camera and says, "Don't worry, we'll get Nixon." And the reason why I love that clip, it speaks to the fact that Howard Baker, the Senate Judiciary Committee, the House Judiciary Committee, put the national interest ahead of partisanship in terms of saying we have to uncover what's going on with Watergate. I don't see that with Mitch McConnell. I don't see that with Speaker Ryan at this point in terms of saying that the integrity of the system is more important than any one individual. And that, again, I think becomes the dangerous point that we are operating with right now, is the complicity, the lack of leadership, the complicity among many in the Republican Party. And that speaks to that broader war. We know that. There's a broader war going on in the Republican Party right now where Trump has displaced, let us say, the old line conservatives, the old line, maybe you agree with them or not, but they cared about the integrity of the system. So this is the scary part. This is the part that I think we have to worry about. What we have to hope for is that we know that Trump's base is still with them. Nothing's going to change their mind. We know where the Democrats are. The battle really is, it's moving the hearts and minds of those independent swing voters. Can we move those people in sort of the center and get them to be the ones that say at the end of the day, we've had enough, we've got to do something? So we're talking at a small percentage of the population that needs to really be moved.
Well, but let's go back to where we started with this conversation, David. And that is that you've got this heated hyperbole coming from the Tea Party congresspeople like Mark Meadows and that Republican dentist from Arizona who is calling the DOJ and FBI people traitors. They're a part of the Tea Party, or the Freedom Caucus, they call themselves. That they are the tail that wags the dog of the Republican Party. They have been empowered by Trump. Trump talks to Meadows all the time now, apparently. And also, the Tea Party was largely created and funded by the Koch brothers. So then you have to ask yourself, what's the motive of the Koch brothers to have this minority within a minority? We have the tyranny of the minority now. We've got an unpopular president and unpopular Republicans doing unpopular things, and yet the Democrats don't have any power to remove them. That's our system, a winner-take-all system. But it's worse than that, because what we're told is that what's left of any decent Republican is being cowed by the fear of being primaried by these Tea Party crackpots. So this is what we have, the tyranny of a minority within a minority.
No, you're absolutely correct. This is, if I can invoke history again, if I invoked once Richard Hofstadter, there was also a British historian, James Bryce, writing at the beginning of the end of the 19th, early 20th century, who described the problem not just being the tyranny of the majority, but it was getting at that whole notion about how minorities might just sort of resign in the face of overwhelming opposition. How, and again, a German sociologist, Elizabeth Noel Newman, later on, described how oftentimes people just sort of give up in the face of in the face of adversity by the majorities. And that, I think, is what we're starting to see here now. What we're seeing here is that those old mainline Republicans have become the minority party within the Republican Party. And they face, I think, increasingly this power from a new majority within the Republican Party that's really redesigning what the Republican Party stands for. And it is a new majority, whether you call it the Koch brothers founded or the Tea Party, and they're in many ways the same thing. But we've got this overlapping Koch brothers, the Tea Party. We've got Fox National. We've got Rush Limbaugh. I mean, in many ways, you know, we have a very, very powerful set of hegemonic forces out here that are not only remaking the Republican Party, but really remaking parts of the Republic and, again, changing or challenging many of the basic values of our political system.
Well, David Schultz, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with David Schultz, who's professor of political science at Hamline University and the University of Minnesota School of Law. He's the author of 30 books and various articles on American politics, ethics, election law, and the media, and most recently, Presidential Swing States, Why Only 10 Matter, Election Law and Democratic Theory, and American Politics in the Age of Ignorance, Why Lawmakers Choose Belief Over Research. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back speaking with an award-winning journalist who has covered the last 10 presidential campaigns. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Walter Shapiro, an award-winning journalist who has covered the last 10 presidential campaigns. He's the author of One Car Caravan, On the Road with the 2004 Democrats Before America Tunes In, and most recently, Hustling Hitler, the Jewish Vaudevillian Who Fooled the Fuhrer, which is about his con man great-uncle. Currently, he's a columnist for Roll Call and a fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University, and he teaches political science at Yale University. And he has an article at The Guardian, The Nunez Memo Shows Republicans Buy Their Own Conspiracy Theories. Welcome to Background Briefing, Walter Shapiro.
I apologize for having all these affiliations and causing such a long intro.
I know, I'm taking up valuable time. But let me ask you, though, about the weaponization of conspiracy theories. My sense is, at this point, it looks as though Donald Trump's going to get away with this.
We don't know. I mean, it depends what get away with it is. His poll numbers, even charitably, as they hit 40%, are 15 to 20% lower than almost any other president since we've had polling. It is looking like the Democrats, the odds are better than 50-50. The Democrats will win the House. We have a Democratic senator from Alabama, and there is no evidence that anyone is being attracted to what Donald Trump is doing. So whether or not Robert Mueller's investigation leads to some sort of removal from office, which I think is unlikely, I really don't think he's getting away with it.
Well, when I say getting away with it, my sense is that he may well be able to shut this thing down, which appears to be his entire motive here. You know, he seems to have laid the groundwork to get rid of Rod Rosenstein. And when people on the left, if you watch MSNBC, of course, you'd think he's about to be either wheeled out of the White House in an orange jumpsuit or a straitjacket. But the reality is I think he's actually in a much stronger position than people recognize, and that he could tough this one out. He's a very brazen character. We've never seen anybody like this before, operating out of the Roy Cohn playbook. And if stopping Mueller is his main focus, which is what we hear from White House reporters, it looks like he may do it. And my question to you would be, everybody says it'll be a constitutional crisis and people will take to the streets. Well, what will that do?
Well, first of all, it's worth remembering, people did not take the streets when Richard Nixon fired Archibald Cox in the Saturday Night Massacre. That the reaction was almost entirely in the media and in the United States Congress. That unlike Vietnam, which had massive demonstrations, or the March on Washington, demonstrations were not the modus operandi during Watergate. And I'm not sure having a large demonstration of people who hate Donald Trump to begin with will convince anyone. What if this were to happen? And remember, he has been talked out of it many times in terms of firing Mueller. If this were to happen, what really is to watch is how many Republicans have a sense of conscience and conviction and a respect for democratic norms. I mean, as crazed as the release of the Nunes memo and Paul Ryan's blessing of it, I found it significant that John Thune, the number three ranking Senate Republican, somebody considered a comer in the Republican Party, someone who is about as orthodox a Republican as you can find, issued a statement really deploring the fact that this memo is being released and that the Democratic counter memo, if it was going to be released, then the Democratic counter memo should have been released as well. So there, you know, I don't want to get too misty-eyed about the Republican Party, since so many prominent Republicans from Paul Ryan on down have made their Faustian bargain. There are Republicans who will only go so far. It is telling that probably the most prominent anti-Trump Republican, Mitt Romney, is going to be heading to the Senate in 2018, and Republican senators are already talking about giving him a leadership role.
But, I mean, what is the Faustian bargain here? My sense is that the Faustian bargain might well be, since the Republicans and Paul Ryan appear to be the enablers, is that they figure that maybe shutting this thing down before November is their best hope.
Well, again, I don't see it. I really, by all polling, firing Mueller would be a disaster for Trump in terms of approval ratings, and not a good thing for congressional Republicans. These are people who want to talk about cutting regulations, and as Paul Ryan tweeted a tweet that was soon after deleted, they want to talk about those wonderful secretaries who are getting $1.50 extra a week in their paycheck.
And again, I'm speaking with Walter Shapiro, who's an award-winning journalist who has covered the last 10 presidential campaigns. He's the author of One Car Caravan, On the Road with the 2004 Democrats Before America Tunes In, and most recently, Hustling Hitler, the Jewish Vaudevillian Who Fooled the Führer, which is about his con man great-uncle. Currently a columnist for Roll Call and a fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University. He teaches political science at Yale University, and he has an article at The Guardian, The Nunes Memo Shows Republicans Buy Their Own Conspiracy Theories. Right, but there are measures short of firing Mueller that would be neutering him, which is what the fear is if somebody comes in and takes Rosenstein's job. I mean, already what Trump appears to have achieved is that he may not have to testify. He has the excuse now saying, why should I testify to Mueller when it's a kangaroo court?
Well, I mean, he can, which then gets tested in the courts. And I'm not a legal expert. I don't even play one on TV. So I'm not saying I can predict how that's going to play out. But basically, what you have is a situation where no one, if he fires Christopher Wray as the second FBI agent director that he would have fired, there is no way. We're constantly dealing with the fact that the Senate does have confirmation powers. And it is impossible under these terms for someone to get through a 51-49 Senate, someone who is going to offer only fealty to Donald Trump and no independent judgment. It is one of the reasons why, after he fired Mueller, after he fired James Comey as FBI director, he had to settle for Christopher Wray, who is proving as independent, if not as outspoken, as Comey.
Right, but he could put in somebody that's already been confirmed, like Scott Pruitt.
I'm not a constitutional expert, but I do not believe the President of the United States has the power to move the EPA administrator to head the FBI.
Well, that was I'm quoting one of those Washington insiders on one of the talk shows who said that was a possibility. But in general, what puzzles me, Walter Shapiro, is that, do you think the Democrats in any way have contributed to this, what's now being called a nothing burger, by being so, you know, so almost like the sky is falling, you can't possibly put this memo out, and by making such a big deal out of it, they have undercut their narrative, which is that there's no there there.
Well, I find it interesting that one of the Sunday shows, retiring Trey Gowdy, who many people remember as the person who was chasing Hillary Clinton over Benghazi, a bit like Captain Ahab or Inspector Javert, has said that it's clear that the Steele memo was not the triggering point for the investigation of Russia. And so, I mean, what you have is, perhaps the Democrats overhyped, oh my God, they're releasing this memo. But the point was, the most powerful thing in releasing this memo was the press release the FBI put out unprecedentedly saying that this is not an accurate memo. And that did more to undercut the validity of this memo than any single speech on the House floor that any Democrat made.
Right, but if you watched Fox News, I doubt whether that was even mentioned, let alone disseminated.
But if you watch Fox News, you didn't need the memo to go down the hole of Sean Hannity conspiracy theories. Why not just say conspiratorially, what about the Steele memo? I mean, you didn't need the letter if you're a true believer.
Well, it's funny, you know, you mentioned some of the analogies there. The analogy that Lindsey Graham gave in reference to Devin Nunes was he referred to him as Inspector Clouseau. So it's an amazing thing to watch that he goes on Fox and Nunes admits that he hasn't even read the underlying FISA case.
No, he delegated a Trey Gowdy to read it for him,
right.
And Gowdy is now on TV as saying that the claims that Trump himself is making about the memo are not true.
Right.
So, I mean, the fact is that perhaps what we're dealing with here is the biggest lie in government is something called the House Intelligence Committee.
Well, at least in terms of the person in charge.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, he's actually called his Democratic colleagues a bunch of liars. I'm quoting that accurately. So it's obviously not there's not a lot of collegiality there, would you say?
No, again, so many arrows keep coming, pointing back to the person who has proven the most spineless creature since God invented the octopus, and that is Paul Ryan, who blessed the release of this memo.
Well, it is an extraordinary thing to watch, and one of the things that seems consistent here is that the extraordinary lack of quality, which is a polite way of putting it, that the Trump appointees exhibit. The idea that when Trump did his editorial board meeting at the Washington Post shortly after his nomination, he was asked about foreign policy, and the first name he gave as a foreign policy advisor was Carter Page, PhD, along with Papadopoulos. And if you look at both of those, you think, my God, You know, talk about the gang that couldn't shoot straight.
Of course, the flip side is that when Carter Page came under attack the fall, September, October, and afterwards, Trump said he barely knew Carter Page. I guess he had some volunteer on some committee, I think, for a short time.
Right. And he did the same with Papadopoulos. He disowned them. But the point I wanted to make was that he's hiring a guy. Not only is the guy goofy and obviously manifestly unqualified, and the other guy, Papadopoulos, who obviously blabbed to an Australian diplomat.
Who made the mistake of believing he could outdrink an Australian.
That's right. Being Australian myself, I understand that. So he, but the point about Carter Page is the FBI was investigating him for being a possible Russian spy when he was hired by the Trump
administration. And Time magazine reports this morning that I think in 2013, Carter Page bragged publicly that he was an advisor to the Russian government.
Well, he made an incredibly anti-American speech at a university in Moscow, and that was what, by the way, what prompted the final extension. But this bogus memo, this so-called nothing burger, clearly the one thing that they apparently was asked to be redacted was the one thing that they really wanted to stress in that, and that is on the first page of the memo when it talks about the Pfizer extensions, and it says then Director James Coney signed three Pfizer applications in question on behalf of the FBI, and Deputy Director Andrew McCabe signed one, then Deputy AG Sally Yates, then Acting DAG Dana Buente, and then DAG Rod Rosenstein, each signed one or more Pfizer applications on behalf of DOJ. Well, if you look at that list, you know, Comey's been fired, so has Sally Yates, McCabe's been forced out, so has Dana Buente. Puts Rod Rosenstein in the crosshairs, doesn't it? If that's the
well, it does point to the enduring genius of that great chooser of human talent, Donald J. Trump, who nominated both Mr. Rosenstein and Mr. Ray for their current jobs.
Well, as I say, I still feel that at this point, he's getting away with it. I mean, would you accept the argument that he kind of got away with the NFL, you know, they're having a Super Bowl today, that take a knee movement, and he obviously weighed in and turned it into a kind of disrespect for the flag and for the veterans? Who do you think won that round? Who do you think won the government shutdown round? And who do you think
Right now, we don't know who won the government shutdown round because we have a new February 8th deadline.
Even sooner, according to the Treasury, they're going to run out of money even sooner.
Oh, no, that's the debt ceiling crisis.
Right.
That's another crisis.
Right.
So, I mean, the whole closing down the government and lifting the debt ceiling, still remains an open book. And I think 90% of voters have already forgotten that the government shut down for a weekend. As for the NFL, I don't do pro football. And it is a religious cause, and so I cannot comment on the fact that the President of the United States seemed to have a particular animus towards African-American football players.
Well, just in closing then, back to the sort of broader picture, is this case now, given that the best explanation for Trump's behavior is, and you pointed out how low his ratings are, is that he is adhering to the base and throwing them a bone constantly while he's distracting all of us with all of his antics. And not a lot of focus has been placed on what he's actually doing legislatively or what's being done. Most of it is.
Well, part of it may be because Donald Trump doesn't know what's being done. I mean, do not underestimate. This is not a man who is micromanaging his appointees, the law enforcement agencies aside.
Right.
So whatever Scott Pruitt is doing, whatever Ben Carson is doing, whatever is happening in the Agriculture Department, it is not as if Donald Trump is ordering it or even knows about it. Remember, this is the man who wants one-page memos with bullet points, no more than nine in large type.
Right. Well, but the fact that he is constantly throwing a bone to his base, and the assumption is that the reason why Paul Ryan and other Republicans are so callow is that they don't want to have to be primaried and deal with this roiling base that Fox News riles up on a constant basis. So do we have a tyranny of the minority in this country?
Well, we have a tyranny of the minority, but we also have a fact that by every measure leading up to the 2018 election, the Democrats are more energized than the Republicans. And what we may have is a majority, a congressional majority, that made a Faustian bargain that starting in January 2019 will be a congressional minority, while Democrats with subpoena power reveal what has been going on in the Trump administration for the prior 2 years.
Well, from your lips to God's ears, and I thank you for joining us. Thank you for joining us, Walter.
Oh, it's always been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Walter Shapiro, who's an award-winning journalist who has covered the last 10 presidential campaigns. He's the author of One Car Caravan on the Road with the 2004 Democrats Before America Tunes In, and most recently, Hustling Hitler, the Jewish Vaudevillian Who Fooled the Fuhrer, which is about his con man great uncle. Currently a columnist for Roll Call and a fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University. He teaches political science at Yale University, and he has an article at The Guardian, "The Nunez Memo Shows Republicans Buy Their Own Conspiracy Theories." We're going to take a brief station break and assess the aspects of today's Super Bowl that the NFL is not emphasizing.
Come on now, who do you, who do you, who do you, who do you think you are? Bless your soul. You really think you're in control?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Ben Carrington, a professor in the Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism at the University of Southern California, where he teaches sociology. He previously taught at the University of Texas at Austin and currently serves on the editorial boards of Identities Global Studies in Culture and Power, the Journal of Sports and Social Issues, and the International Review for the Sociology of Sports. And his latest book is Race, Sport, and Politics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ben Carrington.
Nice to join you.
Well, thank you. On this Super Bowl, I think it's an appropriate subject, the NFL, and there's a number of aspects of the NFL which will not be discussed, I expect, on television today. One of them, of course, is that according to an NBC News Wall Street Journal poll, Americans are turning away from this popular sport, American football. It's dropped 9%, down from 51% over the past 4 years. So let's begin with that. What is the reason, do you think, Ben, for the decline in America's favorite sport?
Well, you're right. There's been a decline, especially in some of the attendance figures for watching not just the Super Bowl today, but the games in general. Although we should put that into context, football remains the most watched sport on American television. Today's Super Bowl will probably be the most watched event of the year. So these are declines, but from very, very high numbers. So it depends how we want to look at the figures. But they certainly had a series of issues. There's been concerns around concussions in the NFL and the treatment of players. A year or so ago, they had a series of high-profile domestic violence issues in the NFL, which kind of damaged the image. And of course, I mean, this needs to be put in the context of the ongoing protests that have taken place with Colin Kaepernick back in 2016. Which were there were some follow-up protests during 2017, that the issue seemed to have died away slightly with a relatively small number of players still protesting up until, of course, Donald Trump made his intervention in the speech in Alabama. I think it was in October, late September, October of last year, when he infamously referred to the players as sons of bitches. And that produced a form of solidarity amongst the players and even, strangely enough, some of the owners kind of standing alongside the players. But it has produced this general kind of sense that the NFL has now become not just a sporting football game, but a political football. And some have suggested that some people have turned away and stopped watching because they think that the NFL has become, quote, too politicized. But it certainly does find itself in a kind of a maelstrom of discussions around identity, politics, race, safety, etc. And so that the brand or the shield, as the NFL owners and commissioner like to talk about it, has certainly taken a dent over the past few months.
Well, it was pretty clear from the State of the Union address a couple of nights ago that when Donald Trump took a swipe at NFL protesters, he got a huge and sustained applause. He was basically talking about a young Preston Sharp, a 12-year-old boy in Redding, California, who placed 40,000 flags on the grave of veterans. And then Trump, praising Sharp, said, "Young patriots like Preston teach us all about our civic duty as Americans. Preston's reverence for those who have served our nation reminds us why we salute our flag, why we put our hands on our heart for the Pledge of Allegiance, and why we proudly stand for the national anthem." Pretty unequivocal, wouldn't you say, Ben Carrington, what he was
referring to? Yeah, you're right. And so when Trump said that piece, which you're right, was a direct attack on the black athletes who have been protesting, and not just in the NFL, but across a range of sports. You're right. I was quite struck by it when I watched it live on TV. That produced the loudest cheer of the evening, followed by chants of USA, USA, USA in the actual chamber itself. For those of us that are familiar with the history of, you know, using sports as a spectacle to whip up nationalistic agendas, which border on the kind, and they're predicated a kind of like a xenophobic and racist exclusion, the kind of fascistic overtones of those moments are really striking. So, it's remarkable that probably the only event which you could say comes close to being like a non-state-sanctioned national cultural event, in other words, today's Super Bowl, has now revealed, I think, some of the always implicit but really explicit deeply nationalistic and often militaristic kind of undertones, which is why, you know, the NFL desperately trying to avoid the kind of the political discussions. But I think it's now overdetermined that the football in particular, and especially these kind of very nationalistic discourses that surround professional sports, men's professional sports in particular, means that it's now a key part of the national discussion around what does it mean to be American, and also, like, are you for or against Donald Trump? Because now, effectively, Trump has drawn the lines to such an extent with those comments that he made during his State of the Union speech that effectively, you know, unless you're willing to speak out against Trump and those forms of overt nationalism, then effectively you're endorsing kind of Trump's vision of American nationalism.
And again, I'm speaking with Ben Carrington. He's a professor in the Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism at the University of Southern California, where he teaches sociology. He previously taught at the University of Texas at Austin and currently serves on the editorial boards of Identities, Global Studies in Culture and Power, the Journal of Sport and Social Issues, and International Review for the Sociology of Sport. In his latest book is Race, Sport, and Politics. So, by the way, the previous guest on today's program, I asked him about whether Donald Trump is winning in terms of the way he's using the Nunes memo perhaps as a pretext to shut down the Mueller inquiry. And he's already won on the tax returns. He hasn't really revealed his tax returns, breaking a precedent. He's won on the emoluments clause. He's still making money while in his office, and his family, of course, is getting richer off him being the president of the United States. But do you think he's also won the take a knee battle with Colin Kaepernick?
It's hard to say. It depends how we're measuring winning and losing. So on the one hand, you could argue that Donald Trump won. I mean, if you going back to his speech in Huntsville, Alabama, you know, the context in which he referred to the players as sons of bitches was, don't you wish some of his owners would tell these sons of bitches to get off the field and that you're fired? In other words, you can protest, but you're going to lose your job. Colin Kaepernick still is not employed in the NFL. He had a whole season where it was clear that he was effectively being blacklisted by the owners. So in that sense, Trump won. Yes, now his call to the owners to make sure that the Kaepernicks of the world are, you know, given a lesson, which means that they will be, you know, they will lose their employment. In that sense, he won. But you could argue the other way. Just actually, Kaepernick has now become a global icon. Kaepernick is now, his message, his calls, the discussions around social injustice, his kind of question of police brutality towards black populations, that's now entered into mainstream discussions. Even some of these sports commentators who don't want to be talking about those issues now have to be kind of at least semi-versed on the topic. And so in a strange way, he's kind of elevated Colin Kaepernick's position. And now, potentially, there was always a group of people for whom Colin Kaepernick was a traitor. And, you know, he didn't deserve to be an NFL player. You know, he should be grateful for what he's got, and he should, quote, just shut up and play. Those people still have that same position, but they were Trump supporters. They were the same people that were in the Huntsville audience clapping Trump, and actually also they started chanting USA, USA at that moment. So that kind of white nationalist strand that Trump relies upon is still against Colin Kaepernick, but that was never going to change. I think what may have shifted, and this is a sense in which we might say that Trump has lost, that there may be some people, quote, in the middle, for whom they think you probably should stand during the national anthem. They think it's disrespectful if you don't do that, and they didn't quite understand what Kaepernick was doing. But they probably were kind of appalled by the language that Trump used. And I think that he may have lost a group of people for whom would now say, well, it seems a bit unfair of what they're doing to Colin Kaepernick. I don't necessarily agree with what he was doing, but it seems disproportionate to call him a son of a bitch. And it's disproportionate that he hasn't been able to play again. So I think in the longer term, actually, I think you could say that Kaepernick won by the very fact of his exclusion, because he revealed the underlying racism, you know, within U.S. society, but within the NFL itself.
So to today's Super Bowl game between the Eagles and the Patriots, the last game, of course, against the Jacksonville Jaguars, which I watched, the Patriots, it was pretty shocking, actually, that the hit that Rob Gronkowski took to a helmet to helmet, it looked like a deliberate sabotaging of the game, in as much as he had a bad concussion and was taken off the field, Gronkowski. Apparently he's going to play today, but he's had them before as well. And this CTE issue is not going away. A movie was made about it with Will Smith, about the Nigerian doctor who first drew attention to this degenerative brain condition caused by repeated blows to the head and concussions. And there's a great deal of concern that it can start very young with young kids and college players, as well as career NFL people, many of whom have ended up in terrible shape. One, of course, prominent player committed suicide because of his brain injury. How much have they dodged a bullet on this, or is this just not going to go away? The NFL, I'm talking about.
Yeah, it's not going to go away, because the NFL is, football is an inherently violent sport. It's predicated upon violence. The entire structure of the game, as it's developed, you know, as players have become stronger and faster, as, you know, sports science has kind of engineered players to, you know, to hit more quickly, more effectively, and harder, means that you're going to see increased forms of head-on-head, body-to-head contact, which cause concussions. Even as the NFL tries to impose some rules to try to mitigate against some of the excesses. And the key thing, I mean, this is another thing to think about, and you're right to kind of point out that one of the issues in relation to concussion isn't so much the single hit to the head in which a concussion is produced, which is bad enough. It's the multiple hits over a period of time. And they don't necessarily have to be huge hits. I mean, sometimes, you know, you'll see the big hits, which tend to get the attraction, you know, especially when, you know, a player catches the ball and goes to turn and they're blindsided by a hit. It can be the repetition of relatively small hits to the head or just the head hitting the ground, which happens a lot, especially for, you know, the quarterbacks and some of the wide receivers. That's intrinsic to the sport. So, I mean, it was interesting. You had that moment last week when Justin Timberlake, who's doing the halftime show, was asked a question, and he said he would never let his son play football. just think about that for a moment. That the person, you know, headlining what for many people was actually a more important and an interesting part of the Super Bowl Sunday, the halftime show, more important than the actual game, said himself that he did not want his son playing football. And he was referencing, of course, you know, the issues of the concussion and damage. And you can just imagine the PR people at the NFL, you know, just like scrambling to try to deal with it. And he's right. So I think, I mean, again, this is one of the unacknowledged parts of why football remains popular. Going back to our earlier discussion, is the violence, you know, and. You know, remember the other thing that Donald Trump said in Huntsville, Alabama, and this got less coverage because of his attack on the players, you know, when he referred to them as sons of bitches. He in that same part of the speech, he then went on to complain that apparently he'd watched a game a week before and the referees were throwing too many flags protecting players for illegal hits. And this Trump said was a bad thing. Yeah, that the game was becoming like wussified, feminized in some way. That, you know, he wants to turn on, you know, the game on a Sunday and watch players smashing the crap out of each other. You know, he likes to see the big hits, which we know means that another human being is being brutalized. So that was part of what Trump was kind of, you know, rallying against. Not just the politicization of the NFL and, you know, black athletes finding a voice. What also troubled him was the fact that he wanted to get enjoyment every Sunday by watching big hits and players being concussed, and that's what he was paying his money for. And so, you know, the kind of spectacle of, you know, predominantly white audiences with almost exclusively white owners producing a sport in which black bodies labor, you know, under conditions which inevitably damage them, is, you know, in some ways a grotesque spectacle, which is why you need the halftime show, which is why you need the promotions and the presentations to kind of to hide those facts. And you're right, there is that potential, I think, for football to be completely, potentially undermined if we ever became concerned for the players. But part of the discourse is, of course, we don't care about the players, you know, and the notion is, well, they get paid a lot of money, therefore we have the right to watch their bodies being abused. And even if the players in their 40s, 50s and 60s come to regret some of their decisions, but then it's too late because we have another cadre of young guys, 15, 16, 17, who are watching the Super Bowl today and want to be you know, in the Super Bowl tomorrow or next year or 5 years from now. So there's enough of a pipeline of, you know, sporting labor to keep the show going. But the question is a moral question for the rest of us, you know, is are we going to tune in to watch? And at what extent, at what point do we begin to genuinely and honestly reflect upon the damage that is being done by a game as violent as football?
Well, Ben Carrington, I thank you very much for joining us here today on this Super Bowl Sunday.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Ben Carrington, who's a professor in the Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism at the University of Southern California, where he teaches sociology. He previously taught at the University of Texas at Austin and currently serves on the editorial boards of Identities, Global Studies in Culture and Power, the Journal of Sport and Social Issues, and the International Review for the Sociology of Sport. And his latest book is Race, Sport, and Politics. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.